how our concerns are being portrayed. And I don't...
Zach, are you ready? You ready?
We have a commissioner in charge who feels very strongly.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the November 10th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll?
Novick?
Here.
Ritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Hales?
Here. Welcome, everyone. We'll get the procedural stuff out of the way here in a moment, and I'll ask our council clerk to read the item. And then, well, why don't you go ahead and do that, because we have a single item on the calendar this afternoon, and I'll talk about the rest.
Item 1259, restrict bulk fossil fuel terminals.
Thank you. So thank you all for being here today. We are citizens of a good place, and it is so good to see you all. So thank you for being part of the legitimate exercise of democracy, and may that always be true in our city and elsewhere. So thank you for coming. Some of you have probably testified at City Council before. I'll go through the procedures quickly so we can hear from you. We are going to have a staff presentation and some invited testimony about this item, and then we'll open it up to public testimony. I know there was a sign-up sheet outside, and hopefully you've signed up. Because of the number of people here, we're going to ask you to limit your comments to 2 minutes apiece, because we want to hear from as many people as possible. If you have already had your views expressed, you can feel free to say so or yield time to another. We have only a couple of ground rules here in terms of testimony. You need give only your name. You don't have to give us your address. When you come up and speak. And if you agree with someone's point of view, feel free to give them a thumbs up or a wave of the hand or twirl something if you have it in your hand. And if you disagree with someone, feel a polite hand gesture to the negative is okay. But we ask always in this chamber that we not make demonstrations, applause, and verbal displays in favor or against our fellow citizens' points of view so that everyone can be heard. We make exceptions for visiting dignitaries and students, and so we might make that exception today because we have some student testimony, and I'm going to exercise the prerogative of having them up early in the process. I know this isn't a school day, but there's still homework. So that's, I think, it in terms of procedures. We have some amendments that we'll consider, but let me open up with some remarks and then set this in motion. The rapid development of fossil fuel resources in the western part of our country and in Canada has put a lot of pressure on Portland and other cities and has sought to transport and move huge quantities of fossil fuels through and into our communities. As we all experienced with the Pembina proposal last year, the zoning code actually allows fossil fuel terminals as a warehouse and freight movement use in our zoning code today without any limit on the size of these terminals. We, of course, passed a resolution saying we're going in a different direction, and today is the proposal to put that into city law, into our code. The amendments in front of us, as we'll have explained in greater detail by the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff, will prohibit all types of new fossil fuel terminals and impose limits on the expansion of existing ones. Through our climate action plan and council resolutions, this council has been on record for a long time to advance policies to reduce fossil fuel use and to oppose oil and coal trains traveling through our city. Last year, we took the step of passing that resolution that I mentioned that stated that we would oppose the expansion of infrastructure whose primary purpose is transporting or storing fossil fuels. We, of course, are also putting a lot of time and effort into becoming disaster resistant, or at least more so, to be more resilient as a city. And many of our employment and industrial zones, including the critical energy and transportation infrastructure in Portland, are located in areas with moderate to high risk of liquefaction. So that's a public safety issue that we need to address as a city. Last month, we adopted a natural hazard mitigation action plan that includes critical infrastructure, a critical infrastructure hub study that outlines the next steps in improving seismic safety for these fossil fuel terminals in the Northwest Industrial Areas along Highway 30 and in Linton. These amendments before us will prohibit all types of new fossil fuel terminals of 2 million gallons or larger and impose limits on the expansion of existing ones to no more than 10% of their current storage capacity. The limited expansion is allowed only in conjunction with the replacement of old tanks, so there is an improvement in that seismic safety if anybody actually is in the process of replacing a tank, something that, by the way, is not happening very often now, and in terms of that seismic resiliency, needs to happen more quickly in order to avoid disaster. So before we hear from our staff, I want to introduce some amendments that clarify the language. That way you will get to testify on those amendments as well as having them explain them. Amendments 1 through 3 deal with language in Title 33, and Amendment 4 amends the ordinance to provide some additional direction for follow-up actions. Amendment number 1 is a technical correction to exception number 4 to clarify that truck-only terminals, the kind of local terminals that we have, are not bulk fossil fuel terminals. Amendment number 2, it makes some changes to exception number 7 to clarify that fuel storage for airports, marine servicing facilities, and rail yards are not bulk fossil fuel terminals. These are basically the filling stations for the airport, the rail yards, and the ships. They exist here today. And amendment number three, clarifies the definition of fossil fuels that by specifying that non-fuel petroleum-based products such as asphalt are not fossil fuels. Actually, what you think about it with asphalt, what happens with asphalt is we take oil and we mix it with gravel and we put it on the street and it stays there for 100 years. So it's not going into the atmosphere. So it's a very different use of petroleum than burning it and releasing hydrocarbons and carbon dioxide. And number 4, as I mentioned, provides additional direction for follow-up actions. So I'm going to propose those amendments and see if there's a second. Thank you. And again, those are before us, and you can testify on those as we proceed. So now I want to call on our Bureau staff, Susan Anderson, the Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Michael Armstrong, and Tom Armstrong, to come up and explain in greater detail what's in front of us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So as the mayor mentioned, I'm Susan Anderson. I'm the director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. With me are Michael Armstrong and Tom Armstrong. And no, they're not related, though. They are sometimes interchangeable.
Irreplaceable, but interchangeable.
Irreplaceable. I just want to start off with a little bit of context for the discussion, and then I'll hand it over to Michael and Tom. You know, cities all over the world are talking about climate change, and some are making big, broad statements, and they're setting up their action plans. But here in Portland, we're doing more, and we're doing much more, and we've been doing it for a long, long time. And we're showing the rest of the world that cities can make a difference. Along with a dozen or so other cities internationally, Portland is seen as a leader on this issue. We've cut carbon emissions by 40% per capita since 1990, and we've cut total emissions by 21%, even while our population increased by more than a third and jobs increased by more than 25%. So we're headed in the right direction. You know, sometimes the actions that cities take are broad and sweeping, like land use regulations that impact housing and transportation and environmental issues and other issues. And sometimes there's actions that we take are very specific and they're very measurable. They're measurable like actions you've taken in the past, things like Clean Energy Works, which resulted in energy and money savings for more than 5,000 homes. Or measurable like cutting city government energy bills, which we've done by $6 million just for last year alone, saving more than $50 million in the past 10 years. We've invested in electric vehicles. We're now buying 100% green power for all city facilities, something that we've been heading towards and are now at for several years. We're requiring energy scores for large commercial buildings, which you did and enacted here 18 months ago, so that future tenants can compare the energy prices in different spaces and owners can see what's possible and what their competitors are doing so that they can make smart investments. And in just a couple of weeks, we're going to ask you to do the same for houses. We're going to have a residential energy score so that home buyers will have the benefit of energy scores when they're looking to buy a house, much like we have miles per gallon ratings for cars. So we know that specific, measurable actions are essential if we're going to reduce the use of fossil fuels. So why am I talking about energy efficiency when what we're going to talk about today is about fossil fuel storage? Well, reducing our demand is essential if we want to meet our climate goals, but it's also essential if we want to limit the size of fossil fuel infrastructure in the future, because demand needs to stay stable or go down if storage facilities are going to be limited. But we know we can do this, and we've shown we can do this over the past 20 years. It started back on City Council 2 decades ago. Mike Lindbergh, Earl Blumenauer were sitting I think that it used to be over there on the other side of the building, but you've been doing the right thing for a long time. I think Mayor Hales, you are all a part of that. With our past record as our proof, we know that we can show the rest of the world that this can be done. So I encourage you all to keep pushing us in the right direction. We have several more projects and policies that will be coming to you quite soon. We have the residential energy score. We have a new electric vehicle strategy that will be coming out, and community solar, hopefully, by next summer. So all these things are going to make a difference. And sadly, given the election, now more than ever, we need local action. We can't rely on the federal government. We can't rely on a future president who doesn't even believe that climate change is real. But we know the science is clear, and clean energy costs are falling dramatically since 2008. Wind costs are down 40%. Photovoltaic costs are down 60%. LED lighting costs are down 90%. So these cost reductions don't just mean it's a smart move from the environment. It's a smart investment. So I look forward to hearing all the testimony this afternoon, and I really, really encourage you to move this ordinance forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Okay, gentlemen.
All right. Mayor and Commissioners, I'm Michael Armstrong with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So the ordinance in front of you this afternoon results from several policies that Council has adopted over the last months, going back to the resolution you adopted almost exactly a year ago, this fossil fuel infrastructure resolution, which had two important pieces. One, to actively oppose expansion of infrastructure whose primary purpose is to transport or store fossil fuels, and at the same time, ensure that those restrictions don't get in the way of improvements to safety, efficiency, seismic resilience, the routine operations, or to get in the way of service to end users. Later, you adopted a policy in the comprehensive plan that's generally around fossil fuel distribution, to limit that distribution to the facilities necessary to serve the regional market. Those policies are based on considerations of a couple different concerns, significantly public safety and environmental risks, both from fossil fuels being transported to Portland, often by rail, sometimes by barge, by pipeline, and also from where those fuels are stored. This map shows the soils that are susceptible to liquefaction, with the darker colors being more susceptible. The large fossil fuel tanks that this ordinance addresses are located primarily along the river in what, for the most part, is moderate to high risk of soil liquefaction. So we're trying to address public safety and environmental risks. We're also trying to respond, as Susan described, to the mounting urgency of climate change. A lot of the work we have to do here locally to reduce emissions is around improving efficiency, installing renewables. At the same time, the globe is transitioning toward cleaner fuels, lower carbon, and overall reductions of emissions. To keep that going in the right direction, we need to keep fossil fuels in the ground. And as Mayor, you pointed out, there are a lot of fossil fuels that are currently coming out of the ground across the western U.S. For us to succeed on climate, we can't let those be exported and burned. At the same time, we recognize that the transition away from fossil fuels will take some time. Portland has a key role geographically as the distribution hub. It supplies about 90%, over 90% of the fossil fuels that serve the state, bits of Southwest Washington as well. And so we know that we need to accommodate the existing infrastructure, and we want to encourage it to move toward safer facilities. Portland's been adding population and jobs, as Susan referred, and at the same time, our fossil fuel use has stayed essentially flat or falling. This slide shows gasoline and diesel use in Oregon over the last 10 years, and the trend is flat, slightly down. The next slide shows natural gas use. This is primarily supplied by pipeline. The trend is a little less, it's a little more uneven, in part due to different winters. There are higher peaks in there as well, and yet the overall trend is flat or falling despite population growth, despite job growth. Now, it's important to keep in mind that even this kind of low to no growth scenario, we may need some tanks in order to help the transition to cleaner fuels. When we bring in biodiesel, when we bring in some of the other low carbon fuels, we do need to be able to store those, to blend those, and the ordinance attempts to address that. So we think we've anticipated those needs. At a more global level, we are seeing big changes in global demand for fossil fuels. And so this chart showing, you know, the earlier 2003 global energy forecast, kind of steady increase, that forecast has been moderated very substantially. So the 2015 forecast is close to flat. You know, not a lot is clear about the future right now. I think it's pretty clear that other countries will accelerate their work to reduce carbon emissions. And so I think we can expect to see more of this in the future. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tom to describe the amendments in detail.
Okay. Tom Armstrong with BPS. I think the mayor, in his opening remarks, did a good job of providing an overview of what the zoning code amendments do to implement the policy directions in the resolution that you passed last year. Essentially, what we're doing is defining a new type of use, a new category of use called bulk fossil fuel terminals, and we're characterizing that use. We are essentially prohibiting that use in all of the base zones, which primarily applies to the industrial zones. And then we're coming up with some standards to say, once we've prohibited that use, what do we do with the existing terminals? And the PSC recommendation before you is to make them limited uses that allow them to continue to operate, allow them to make investments in seismic improvements, and limit the expansion of their storage capacity to no more than 10% of what they have today. A couple of key things here, you know, how we define fossil fuels and what's a fuel versus another petroleum product was one of the challenges we had through this process, especially also when we look at things like natural gas and biogas and how you tell the difference between the two and what that source comes from. And so we've settled on a definition that refers to decayed plants and animals that lived millions of years ago and are used as a source of energy. And as the mayor has said and proposed in his amendments, we have some exclusions in that definition to make it clear that non-fuels and other renewable fuels, such as ethanol or renewable diesel, are not included in that definition, and so that we provide sort of the opportunity for that transition to the cleaner fuels. We, as I said, we've defined what a bulk fossil fuel terminal is, and it is what we call a gateway facility. It has access to a marine dock or a railroad spur or a pipeline, and it has a significant amount of storage capacity. The recommendation before you from the Planning and Sustainability Commission lowered that threshold capacity from 5 million gallons to 2 million gallons, roughly equivalent to the amount of oil that can be stored in one unit train. They thought that was a good benchmark in terms of what represents a large facility that has a sort of wider impact. Based on your resolution last year, we, again, have a number of exclusions or clarifications of who's not included, who doesn't get captured within this definition. And as the mayor said, we had some technical amendments to make clear, especially with respect to airports and marine and rail servicing facilities that are essentially the gas stations for those larger type uses, are not included in this definition of what a bulk terminal is. As I said, you know, we have 10 of these petroleum-based terminals out in the Northwest Industrial District, and then one Northwest Natural LNG facility. And so a key thing was what to do with them, and the Planning and Sustainability Commission really sort of considered a range of options, whether to make them a non-conforming use or a conditional use. In the end, they settled on a recommendation to make them what we call limited use, to limit their expansion of their storage capacity to 10%, and that in order to unlock that 10%, it has to be a replacement. It's just not new storage capacity. You got to replace an old tank, and that's where we get a little bit of a seismic upgrade benefit, because the new tanks have to comply with the current seismic codes. At the same time, they recommended that there, for those type of tank replacements, that there should not be a land use review that introduces some uncertainty in the process and potential delays through appeals, that they wanted to provide a clear path to have those seismic replacements happen. In exchange for that, they required a public notice and meeting prior to the filing of a development permit for these tanks. This is similar to what we do with multifamily residential buildings, in that when a developer comes forward, he needs to notify the surrounding neighborhood, he needs to have a meeting to explain the proposal, and then the neighborhood is at least aware of what's going on. They can make their views known, but it does create some public awareness of what types of activities will be happening out on these existing terminals. Again, just a little graphic of how that replacement and storage capacity work. If you have, say, a facility with 50 million gallons of current capacity, they can decide which combination of tanks they want to replace. They can replace it one for one. They could replace it with a larger one. But the idea is we're removing these older tanks that aren't up to current codes and replacing them with new tanks that are. I think you'll hear also from our bureau partners at PBEM and FIRE about the seismic safety concerns and the slow pace of turnover in terms of the existing tanks that are out there. These zoning codes really address sort of that future growth and expansion. It doesn't really get at the issue of how to improve the safety of what's out there today. Absent, you know, sort of flat or declining demand, is there really going to be a need to expand capacity? And that's going to require additional steps beyond what we address in these zoning code changes today. Just to reiterate what the mayor's put on the table in terms of the four amendments, there are three amendments to the zoning code to really clarify our intent as to what is a bulk or not a bulk fossil fuel terminal and what is not a fossil fuel in terms of those other products like asphalts and lubricants. And then an amendment to the ordinance to provide some additional direction to us and to our bureau partners to both report back to you on the effect of what these regulations has, especially as it relates to the issue of sort of the fuel supply for the region and the state in terms of how that fits with our growing economy and population, but also continued direction to the city bureaus to work on this issue with the state of Oregon with respect to the seismic upgrades of the existing tanks. And with that, that is the end of my remarks. If there's any questions.
Questions at this point?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. So a 10% expansion of a terminal?
Yes.
Just counts the storage space itself, not any associated piping or pumping that goes with it?
Correct. I mean, the piping is the transloading and the movement of product, but between the source and the individual tanks and to however it's being conveyed out of the facility. And so storage, that's movement. Storage is the tanks themselves.
Okay. Thank you.
So we're putting that 10% in to try to encourage the companies to change their tanks. So am I correct in thinking we're not allowed to say just do it?
Currently, under state law, the seismic upgrades are a building code issue, and it's similar to what we're struggling with the unreinforced masonry buildings. And so absent a program similar to that URM program that inventories all the tanks that are out there and comes up with some sort of deadline. You have 10 years, 15 years to replace these. This is an incentive and a hedge. It's an incentive to provide some cost recovery to those seismic upgrade improvements. It's also a hedge against that demand curve that Michael showed in terms of, you know, some uncertainty about how much additional storage capacity these facilities might need to comply with the state's clean fuel standards. Because those are going to come on board over the next 10 years, they need additional capacity for fuel additives like ethanol. They need additional blending to comply with those standards. The ethanol tanks themselves aren't subject to these regulations, but the blended fuel capacity would be. And so this is a way of providing them a little bit of flexibility to also comply with those clean fuel regulations.
And do we know what the life expectancy of a tank is?
A very long time. There are tanks out there that are more than 50 years old. So
I'm just thinking of, you know, the Water Bureau. Once in a while we have to place those tanks. So do we think do we know how many tanks are going to reach the end of their useful life anyway?
Not with any precision, but we do know that there's over 300 tanks out there, and we've seen somewhere on the order of 15 to 20 tank replacements or new tanks come in over the last 10 to 15 years. So it's been a very slow replacement period, Nate Takara, the fire marshal, when he gets up, he's more familiar with what's out there today and those risks involved, that he may be able to speak to that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. These folks will be standing by for more questions if we have them, but let's go ahead and complete our staff presentation by asking Nate Takara, our fire marshal, and Jonathan Paethemu from our Bureau of Emergency Management to come up and tell us their perspective, please. I'll embarrass her on the way up to say that Jonna, by the way, is doing double duty and is also our Northwest 23rd Avenue Recovery Manager, and she's doing a great job in helping the community get back on its feet. So thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Hales. My name is Jonna Popeff-Themieu, and as you said, I work for the city's Bureau of Emergency Management, and in there at the Bureau, I am the lead on the city's Natural Hazard Mitigation Plan. So we talked about that plan at council last month, and as you mentioned in your introduction, natural hazards, including flooding, drought, heat waves, and severe storms are all intensified by global warming. So as emergency manager, I see very clearly how important it is for the city to do its part to reduce climate impacts, and I think this proposal is very worthwhile for that reason alone. In terms of local vulnerabilities, the critical energy infrastructure hub, the Tank Farms in Linton, is an area of significant risk for the entire state of Oregon. The particular issue of earthquake risk in Linton has long been an area of focus for our Bureau, and as part of the update to that natural hazard plan, which Council adopted, PBEM commissioned a focus study on the Linton area. And what our consultants found was that the majority of the facilities in the CEI hub are constructed to no or low seismic standards. And they're mostly located on soft, liquefiable soils that are typically associated with increased seismic vulnerability. So the code changes that are proposed today limit the expansion of these facilities, and that is another reason to support it. I think Nate will say more. I think there is definitely more work to be done in this regard with respect to the building code and getting at the retrofits of existing facilities. But one more thing, as you already alluded to, PBEM's a small bureau. I do wear many hats. So in addition to being the lead on the Natural Hazard Mitigation Plan, I am the recovery manager for the Northwest 23 gas explosion. That explosion was incredibly dangerous and destructive. It also involved a very tiny amount of fuel compared to what is stored in even one small industrial storage tank. And I think this incident reminds us that even with a fuel like natural gas, which is generally very safe and a technology that's very well understood, nothing is foolproof. So preventing new large terminals inside the city limits is the only approach that is 100% certain to protect residents of Oregon's largest city from a major industrial accident. So this is the third reason that the Bureau of Emergency Management supports these changes. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for allowing me to testify this afternoon. I would like to thank Director Anderson and her team for the work they've put forward to get the fossil fuel zoning amendments brought to council this afternoon. I like the fact that we are talking about this important subject regarding the bulk terminal fuel farms, and I support the concept of finding ways to limit the growth of these facilities. However, I do have some concerns with the proposal because it primarily focuses on limiting the growth of these facilities. Unless there are additional steps that are being considered to complement this amendment, the proposal alone will not make these facilities safer today. In recent years, when these facilities construct new larger tanks, they were mandated to install these tanks to current structural fire and life safety standards. This includes the most critical liquefaction requirements. Although these tanks are generally larger than the ones being replaced, there are cumulative benefits with new tanks when new tanks are installed. These tanks are installed to current code requirements, and from a fire life safety perspective, these tanks are considered to be much safer than the ones being replaced. Just as important, during the installation of these tanks, several key fire and life safety components are evaluated, such as containment, spill control, and fire safety equipment, to ensure that they meet current code. Overall, this has a positive impact on the overall safety of these facilities. Moving forward, I believe in order to make these facilities safer, if council decides to limit the size of these facilities, then I strongly encourage council to consider creating initiatives or initiating the development of new code requirements for mandatory structural fire and life safety upgrades for existing tanks to meet current code requirements.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's exactly what we want to make sure we report mm-hmm. back, because there's more work to be done besides exactly. the policy and the zoning code itself. So thank you. Questions? Thank you both very much. So now we have a couple of panels to call. First involves policymakers that are affected by this. We, thanks to our tribal liaison, Pat Gibson, we have made sure that we always are in good communication with tribal governments, and we have Kathleen George, who's the tribal councilwoman from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde here. We also have Mayor Arlene Burns, who's the mayor of Mosier. I think we're going to have Peter Cornelson, who's a Hood River City Council member. Yes, he is here. Representative Lou Frederick from here in Portland, and the district that contains all that liquefiable soil you just saw. So,
Senator-elect.
Thank you, Lou Frederick. So, welcome. Good afternoon. So good to have you all here.
Thank you very much.
Start, Kathleen.
Sure. Thank you very much. Hayumasi, Mayor Hales, and all of our commissioners, thank you so much for inviting the Grand Ronde Tribe to speak to this important issue before you today. Our relationship with the City of Portland is of critical importance to us and of great value, and we always appreciate your including us when decisions are made that affect our precious Willamette River, upon which Portland depends and many, many Oregonians depend. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, of course, maintain their relationship with their ceded lands and with this river, and we return to it every year to fish and to celebrate our fisheries, which travel right through downtown Portland up the Willamette River to the Grand Ronde Reservation. Our salmon and our skockwool, our eels, pass through and reside in the Willamette and are affected by it. And, of course, the lives of our tribal members and all Portlanders are affected by the river and the pollutants that go into it. And, of course, the decision before you today does not occur in a vacuum and is not only considered in light of this particular fossil fuel terminal zoning decision. We know, of course, that our Willamette River is a Superfund site. And right now, the Environmental Protection Agency, Department of Environmental Quality, and many organizations are considering how we can heal this deeply, deeply wounded river. And so it is in this context that a consideration of expanded opportunities for pollution or safety concerns that could cause future pollution are of the utmost importance. The Grand Ronde Tribe remains deeply committed to healing our fisheries that reside and depend upon this river and all the people who depend on the river. Tribal people and other people who rely on fish to feed their families are at higher risks whenever pollutants are in our river and in our fish. And just as Portland Harbor has the potential and is affecting our fish and our people, pollution from safety threats at fossil fuel terminal zoning issues and facilities have the potential to affect that as well. Not only do we have the recent tragedy in Portland of the explosion, but we also remember the recent Mosier train derailment of last year where our rivers were polluted. this year.
Yes.
I'm sure you will help us remember that in great detail. And we need to remember that the very best laid plans can go awry. While we certainly appreciate the opportunity for increased safety measures and the replacement of old tanks, we do need to share that our concerns are that continued fossil fuel terminal development or any opportunities for expansion would introduce additional risk of harm to an already damaged and degraded ecosystem, and that any continued fossil fuel terminal development would be unacceptable to Grand Ronde, because we feel that right now, as a community of Oregonians, our focus needs to be on improving our safety, healing our river, our fisheries, to protect our people. And the potential benefit of fossil fuel development, in our opinion, has not been shown to be worth the cost to Oregon's priceless natural and cultural resources. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you very much for being here. Thank you. Mayor Burns, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much for the invitation and for all the hard work you are doing. I'm Arlene Burns, and I'm the mayor of Mosier. In this crucial time, more than ever, we need to proactively address the threats imposed by fossil fuel infrastructure expansion and development that will negatively affect not only the city of Portland, but all communities along the tracks. As everyone knows, on June 3rd, the city of Mosier experienced the derailment of a 96-car unit train of Bakken crude, which was on its way to an existing terminal in Tacoma. This train was going less than 30 miles an hour on a relatively straight piece of track. Only because it was a rare windless day, we did not lose our town. Now we are experiencing 4 or 5 of these unit trains per month, but if the Vancouver facility is built or expansion of existing facilities in Portland is allowed, this could increase to 4 or 5 unit trains a day or more. We are fighting for our lives out in the Columbia River Gorge, as infrastructure development is being pushed even in front of Mosier, where the train derailed, to facilitate the proposed terminals, even despite the fact that ours is a national scenic area, supposedly protected and protecting tribal rights. We need your help. After yesterday's national election, one thing is clear. It's up to us to be the innovators and the leaders in progressive city codes and resolutions, to not only protect our future, but to be a template for the rest of the country. Especially in the light of seismic risk, we need to focus our efforts on industry development that will not increase the hazards during a seismic event. I'm thankful and probably never prouder to be an Oregonian and serve as an elected official, because I believe that the future is in the hand of committed individuals who collectively can lead the way to a sustainable future. Mayor Hales and this entire council have shown leadership by passing a landmark fossil fuel resolution. By adopting binding rules that take bold action, you will also be helping all of the towns along the tracks, daunted by the possibility of the Columbia River Gorge becoming a superhighway for fossil fuel transportation. I urge this council to take the strongest stand possible, not only to protect our future, but to lead the way. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate you being here. Councilmember Cornelson, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Hales and commissioners. My name is Peter Cornelison, and I'm a council member from Hood River, Oregon. And both the city of Hood River and the county of Hood River have passed resolutions unanimously opposing oil by rail through the Columbia Gorge. We're joined by at least 6 other communities or agencies in the Gorge who have adopted similar resolutions. The oil train fire and spill that happened in Mosier this summer was only 7 miles away from our city of 7,000 people. Our entire downtown is within the half-mile blast zone of an oil train explosion. So we're quite at risk. In the Gorge, we live under the daily threat of another oil train explosion. Oil trains travel on both sides of the river, Oregon and Washington, and a fire or a spill would impact the entire gorge. For instance, this summer when the derailment happened in Mosier, I-84 was completely shut down, as well as Washington Highway 14. And most local fire departments were responding to the emergency in Mosier. They weren't available for any local emergencies. we see your fossil fuel resolution as the best way for our communities to be protected. We know we can't stop rail traffic, but if the terminal capacity is not there, then they won't be coming through the gorge. We salute your leadership on this issue and the work you've done on a climate action plan. We in Hood River look at that as an example as we try and craft our own. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Frederick, welcome. Senator-elect Frederick, I got to get used to that new title. I bet you like the sound of it. Thank you for being here. Push the button on the base of that microphone. There we go.
There we are. All right. Thank you very much, Mayor Hales and member of the City Council. I am Lou Frederick, state representative from District 43, North and Northeast Portland, and senator-elect from a much larger area that has the same description. My Senate district includes import and export facilities that serve the entire state. In fact, just about any goods coming to or leaving Oregon have to pass through the facilities in my district. That's on the airport, that's the railroads, that's the Columbia River, the Willamette River. It's all of the Port of Portland east of the Willamette River, basically. It's a pretty large-scale area. Looking forward to it. Now, that represents substantial opportunities for those who live nearby, but also substantial risks when we talk about the movement of fossil fuels. While a major incident at a fossil fuel export facility would be catastrophic to the state, it could very well be unsurvivable in large areas of Northeast Portland. And recovery, to the extent even possible, could last longer than the market for those fuels. It should also be noted that when we export fuels across the Pacific Ocean, we get them back in the form of greenhouse gases and pollution on the prevailing winds. The picture of how unsustainable that is becomes terrifyingly clear every day. Portland's Climate Action Plan sets a goal of 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. We can't get there without moving faster than we are. And as part of that, we have to take some responsibility for the gases generated during and following export through our port. This is a global problem. The environmental, social, and economic repercussions, the human cost, depend on what happens in China just as much as what happens here. We can't, at least in the short term, count on effective actions at the federal level. I believe that Portland should exercise whatever authority it has to limit both local and global use of fossil fuels. This problem belongs to all of us. And after the events of this week, this is a time for us to show what stewardship of the environment and our neighborhood looks like. Maybe we can teach the rest of the nation what a future can be. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you all. We appreciate you very much.
May I ask a question of anybody who wants to answer it? Obviously, the big question here is should we allow the 10% expansion in order to encourage building of tanks that are earthquake safe? And so I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on that specific question. Is it worth giving a little bit of expansion in order to get some seismic upgrades? Because we're not allowed by the state yet to just say you must do it by then. So where do each of you come down on yes or no on the 10%?
Well, I think that the 10% acts as an incentive if we can get something done. We need to get something done quickly. And that's the concern that I have. We need to not only get something done in terms of seismic issues. I'm really very concerned about the seismic issues. The report that you just heard from your city sustainability person was saying very clearly there's zero to maybe a few percent of those tanks that are, in fact, safe enough in case of an earthquake. And that we're not talking about the huge earthquake, just an earthquake. And the fault line is right there. The liquefaction issues, I'm reminded of what took place during the World Series quake in San Francisco, where the downtown just became jello. If it becomes jello under those tanks, we lose North Portland.
Thank you. Other thoughts on that question?
I'm not sure exactly what the 10%, if it was at full capacity of all the terminals, that ends up being quite a lot. But I agree that whatever one can do to upgrade the tanks to be more safe, for example, what's happening with the railroad right now, they have these other tanks for shipping crude, but they're not going to be online for a long time. And in the meantime, the CEO of Union Pacific told us that, we're charging them more per tank to use the old ones, so the railroad is actually profiting more using the old tanks. So they don't have much incentive to get them online either. So I think it's a really crucial, crucial issue. And if that incentive could really manifest itself as a requirement, it's a sort of, then it seems worth it. But otherwise, it's bringing a larger burden to a situation.
And I think I would have to agree on behalf of the tribe. Philosophically, we would prefer to not have to have any expansion of capacity. And that being said, we understand that as the situation is today, there is really no other incentive to encourage that change. And being as aware as we are of the seismic issues here on the Willamette River and in the heart of Portland, with our community all around us, it seems that, you know, safety has to be of paramount importance. If this serves as that incentive, then I think it's perhaps necessary at this time, although unfortunate, we really don't want to see more fuel there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That helps. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay, a couple more people to call, and then we'll turn to the sign-up sheet. We have a representative of our Planning and Sustainability Commission, the most overworked volunteers in Portland, Gary Axman, and Pam Neal from the Portland Development Commission with an economic analysis. So, welcome, Dr. Axman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Hales, commissioners. I'm Gary Axman. I'm a member of the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Let me offer a couple of framing comments to start with here. First of all, the Planning and Sustainability Commission was extremely enthusiastic in support of the resolution that passed by the City Council. So we're totally on board with that. We see that as an integral part of the Climate Action Plan and a very important step to be taking. We were also very concerned about safety and specifically the risk of an earthquake and large-scale earthquake. That kind of earthquake occurring in the high-risk soils where most of the fossil fuel infrastructure is located currently will produce a local and a regional environmental catastrophe, and will also produce a local human health catastrophe. Surviving without fuels in the post-earthquake environment is going to be a very, very bleak situation. So, so that imbued a lot of the Commission's thinking. We also, while we did not take a formal position on other approaches to seismic improvement, we did have some rich conversation about that, and particularly the desirability of a comprehensive approach to seismic stabilization. As has been outlined by others, other panels, basically the Planning Commission took four changes to what was originally proposed to us as a policy in a zoning code. It reduced the size allowed for new fossil fuel tanks from 5 million down to 2 million gallons. And again, that was thought that that produced adequate flexibility for people to continue their business and to blend environmentally sustainable fuels, but at the same time attempting to discourage the use of large unit trains for oil transport. Secondly, we went with the decision to go with a limited use rather than other options. Specifically, what we heard from testimony is that the current current providers and the current businesses that run fossil fuel need some degree of certainty about what the environment is going to be. And so the limited use created a clear pathway to future seismic stabilization, and that was our major concern. Going along with that, the third recommendation was we decided not to require land use review. And again, we wanted the clear path, and it wasn't clear what a land use review would really add in terms of value to considering a proposal for tank replacement or seismic upgrade. And lastly, we added what we thought were some pretty good protections against aggregating of multiple small businesses into a larger business that effectively overcomes the limit, and so we tried to cut that off. So that was really that was basically the approach that the commission took. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Questions for Dr. Oxman? Thank you very much. Appreciate your work on this and everything else we've put on your plate.
I'm sorry.
Appreciate your work on this and everything else we've put on your plate. So thank you.
Okay. Well, on behalf of the commission, we thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Neal, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Mayor, commissioners. My name is Pam Neal, and I am the Clean Energy Liaison for the Portland Development Commission. I am going to give you testimony about Portland's clean tech economy. Portland's 40 years of progressive policy around climate and sustainable innovation has made the city internationally renowned as a place that has found the balance between growth and the quality of life. In the past, it's been difficult to quantify the size of our clean tech sector because of the federal government's industrial classification system hasn't adapted to the industry. For example, an employee at Portland's Indo Windows would be classified under building materials rather than as a manufacturer of highly efficient window inserts, and a software engineer at Jaguar Land Rover working on autonomous vehicles would be classified under motor vehicles. Under the leadership of Mayor Hales, we recently did a pilot with the C40 Climate Leadership Group that sought to quantify what is called the low-carbon economic goods and services sector. While the information hasn't been publicly released, we do have top-line analysis to share that can finally demonstrate a link between Portland's climate leadership and the creation of a sizable industry in itself. The data shows that the low-carbon economic goods and services sector is a $10 billion industry with an average of 5% growth since 2012. The sector has an employment of almost 47,000 and is composed of 2,450 companies. For more than 5 years, Portland has been in the enviable position of being a net exporter of low-carbon goods and services. It should be noted that this data that was modeled includes Clackamas and Washington counties, in addition to Multnomah, but we believe that this is an accurate look at the local sector. Other analysis we've conducted shows that the sector is very rich in middle-wage jobs, defined as earning higher than $42,000 per year and requiring less than a bachelor's degree. Portland has never been afraid to prioritize sustainability and the health and well-being of its people, as we've demonstrated by removing a highway on our waterfront and making a park. We were the first city in the U.S. to have a green infrastructure and a green building policy. We were early to sign up for the Kyoto Protocol, and we signed into the historic Paris Climate Agreement. We brought back the modern streetcar, and last fall celebrated the completion of a multimodal bridge that excludes cars. We've created a thriving and equitable 21st century economy that sees vast potential for growth as the world looks for solutions in lowering carbon. In addition, we've created a Portland brand around sustainability and innovation that is recognized around the world, whether it's China, Japan, or our sister city in Guadalajara, Mexico, which I recently visited with a team of Portland clean tech firms, the State of Oregon, and the mayor's office. The trajectory of our climate policy has been working. We will continue to embrace the policies and the programs that have fostered a better city and job creation for Portland residents.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your work in quantifying what we all hoped was happening in our city. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you both very much. Okay, we're going to turn to public testimony. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to give students a chance to come first. That's good news and bad news. It's good news because it's great to hear from students. It's bad news because they're a hard act to follow. But if you're here as a student, come on up and we'll give you first opportunity if you'd like that, or if you want to wait a while and come up later, that's okay too. So if there's some students in the chambers, either upstairs or down, come on up, please. Okay, well, that's good. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Tyler Hahn.
My name is Gabby Lemieux.
Tucker Holston.
And we all attend Lincoln High School. It is great to once again see the members of the City Council after our visit here last Thursday. During our time in school, and especially in the first months of our environmental justice and sustainability class at Lincoln, we have learned about the issue of climate change. We have learned how, without immediate action, the fate of the world will be imperiled within our lifetimes. Many of the people in this room were alive as the entire world was held hostage by the imminent threat of nuclear annihilation presented by the arms race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. A tragic mistake could have resulted in the end of humanity as we know it. However, the issue of climate change is significantly more frightening. Unlike nuclear war, if we do nothing and simply continue down the path that we have followed for decades, climate change will wreak havoc on our world.
We have all lived in Portland our entire lives. We have visited countries, other countries and states, but we always long to return to the rich green forests, the staggering snow-capped mountains, the broad, powerful rivers, and the open-hearted people of the Northwest. Many times we have driven through the gorge and thought aloud how lucky we are to live in a place of such unparalleled majesty. But now, every time we witness the beauty of this corner of the world, we cannot escape a certain lingering sorrow. We imagine that so many of the things that we love might soon be gone. We see the trees parched, the mountains defeated and unable to carry snow, the rivers choked and empty of salmon, all ravaged by climate change. And these worries are not just contained to the beautiful Pacific Northwest. Across the world, it is already happening.
We constantly hear our elders say that this is the greatest issue of our time and that they shouldn't have left us with such a mess. While these things are true, we cannot afford for you to simply pass this issue on to us. We know that we have to stop building new fossil fuel infrastructure now if we are to have any hope of remaining within reasonable emission limits and preventing climate chaos. Yet fossil fuel companies continue to operate unchallenged by the government and intend to extract 5 times as much carbon as we can safely utilize. We don't have time to wait around for a few more decades, a few more election cycles. We need to start an aggressive transition to renewable energy now.
In spite of the challenges ahead, we have found huge sources of inspiration in our own communities. The walkout at Lincoln was a turning point for us and for many other students. We distinctly remember standing on the east side and looking across the Hawthorne Bridge. The line of students was so long that the protests spanned the entire bridge back to the west side. Over 1,000 students walked out on September 7th, demonstrating to us that we have the power to make our voices heard. When we saw that there were people willing to stand up for what they believe in, we knew we didn't have to wait around and hope for a better future. We knew that we could start shaping our own destiny. However, change cannot wait until our generation begins to run for public office and to write our own legislation. The change has to start with you. If we don't begin right now, by the time we are old enough to hold public office, it will already be too late.
We heartily appreciate the City Council's support to stop the development of all new fossil fuel terminals and to limit the construction of petroleum storage tanks to under 2 million gallons. However, we must stress the need for tighter restrictions against any expansion of fossil fuel storage tanks. The City of Portland needs to do more than just ban holding tanks over 2 million gallons. We need a full ban on all new storage infrastructure. We can't allow a 10% volume expansion on tanks. This would make the city liable for millions of gallons of additional fuel capacity that would increase our potential future contributions to climate change or devastate the river and surrounding waterfront in the event of a seismic disaster. So, if a 10% volume expansion is truly the only way to ensure our safety in the event of a seismic disaster, then I simply express my frustration and hope deeply that the irony is understood by all of us and that our message will not be lost on fossil fuel companies.
We are done waiting. The initiatives already passed in this city should constitute the jumping-off point for creating a better future for all, one that is healthy, just, and sustainable. We need a fundamental change in the way that we address our priorities. We must follow an ideal similar to that which was outlined in the Iroquois Confederacy. In our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next 7 generations. This kind of thinking would allow us to stop acting as if short-term economic growth is more important than all else, and instead favor a cooperation among people, governments, and the Earth for the greater good of all on this fragile planet. As NASA's Voyager 1 spacecraft was flung out of the solar system at 11 miles per second, the onboard cameras were pointed back toward the Earth. Encapsulated in the glare of sunlight was a tiny, pale blue dot, a world teeming with life against the backdrop of near infinite and inhospitable space. This is our world, and we stand as a city in one small corner of it. While our world is, in a cosmic sense, fragile and small, this only verifies that as the caretakers of this world, we have the power to alter our course if we so choose. We have the chance to begin an aggressive global transition away from fossil fuels right here, right now in Portland. We believe that banning all expansion on fossil fuel storage facilities in the city of Portland is the only logical next step, the only one that can result in a promising future for the city and the world. We need to write the history of the world and